Bill Zemi is probably the preeminent celebrity interviewer of our time. His work has appeared in Playboy and Vanity Fair and most recently in Esquire. I've been reading his work for a long time, but I haven't been able to get all of it in print until now, when he has put together a collection of some of his best pieces, and they are really more profiles than just interviews. In a new book that's just been released called Intimate Strangers, Comic Profiles and Indiscretions of the Very Famous. And I'm happy to welcome him back to the show today. Hello, Bill.
How are you doing down there?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you. As I say, I'm a fan of your work, and in reading through this, you've got some, you know, major names here, from Sinatra to Letterman to Leno to Regis to Madonna to Warren Beatty to Eddie Murphy. How do you choose the subject of a Bill Zemi profile?
Don't you think Regis, by the way, is really flattered you put his name in that whole lineup?
I'm sure. Well, we're going to get to Regis. I'm sure he's shocked to be included in that lineup, although I have an expectation that he expects to be in that lineup.
Yes, he would. Yeah. Right, well, how could he be left out?
You know what? While we're on the subject, let's start right there. You and Regis have a relationship that includes you helping to co-author at least one, maybe two of his books, right?
Two of his books, yes. I'm Only One Man, and Who Wants to Be Me? And all based on the fact that I wrote a profile. But the second thing I did when I went over to Esquire in '94 was a profile of Regis, and he turned out to be like just a wonderful subject. You know, the truth of the matter is he's a fantastic broadcaster, and Letterman just loves the guy. He thinks, as you would probably guess if you see if you watch Dave regularly, Regis is always there one way or another making trouble.
Yeah.
But he's just a pure broadcaster, a man who can just go on the air and go from the top of his head, kind of like what you're doing, Paul.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I will tell you, I think the highest compliment you can pay somebody in this business is to call them a broadcaster. And Regis fits that. Letterman fits that. Bob Costas fits that. That's a fairly elite category, and Regis certainly is in that category. But you know this guy. Is he as manic off the air as he is every day for an hour on the air?
Oh, pretty much. He's pretty much what you see is what you get. He's actually one of the nicest guys. I mean, in all the of all these people in show business that I have had to deal with, he's actually probably the kindest, most decent man I know. But he's also, on the other hand, he's Regis. He's on fire.
And he's always upset about something, isn't he?
It's always about indignity, you know. He's been, he gets the short end of the stick. He's turned his indignation into sort of grandeur, and that's kind of what we celebrate in the piece that's in this book.
You know, it's funny because he literally is the guy who's mad as hell. He's not going to take it anymore. He has become that Peter Finch network character personified.
He's the guy who gets the bad seat at the dinner, and
right.
You know, can't see beyond the pole or whatever it is. He's the everyman. He's like Daffy Duck.
How is he like Daffy Duck?
Well, yeah, Daffy Duck always got the short end of the stick, and he's always angry.
That's true, I suppose.
Yeah.
I've had Regis on the show many times, and in fact, when I worked in Washington, D.C., his son Danny was a big fan of my show, and so I got to know Danny by email, and so Regis would come on the show. But that's one topic that Regis is kind of reticent to talk about, but you got him to talk about Danny a little bit.
Well, absolutely, and I've gotten to know certainly all of his kids for the most part. Danny, from his first marriage, was, you know, unfortunately, he was born with a birth disorder and really had no use for his spine and his legs. He had to lose his legs very early on, and it's kind of a heartbreaking story. Regis doesn't like to milk sympathy at all, and therefore he takes very good care of the kid. But he's not a kid now; he's a grown man,
right?
And a bright guy.
Yes,
heavens. When he was in Washington, didn't he work for the Pentagon?
Yes, he did. He was a big shot at the Pentagon, as a matter of fact, and one hell of a guy. And you're right; that's one of those things that people don't know about Regis. And there was a scandalous story that was printed in one of the tabloids, which I'm not even going to go into here today. But they should be ashamed of what they did to Regis. But
right.
But let's get back to him and his relationships. You mentioned Regis and Letterman, another guy who you have a relationship with, which we have to get into here. But tell me about the Regis Philbin David Letterman relationship. Is there one that doesn't exist on television?
No. It's purely, much to Regis's chagrin, and yet it's hilarious. Regis is dying to, you know, get Letterman out of the, you know, out of the office to go out to dinner, but Letterman won't go out in public. Generally, he eats at his desk. He'll very rarely go out in public and eat dinner, certainly not in New York City. Regis is always there for Dave. You'll remember that he was the the last guest Letterman had before he went in for the heart operation, and the first guest he had back, and certainly the first guest he had after 9-1-1 too.
Yep, and also filled in a couple of nights for Dave when Dave was out with the, you know, hospitalized there, and
for the quintuple bypass. Yeah, I mean,
right.
It's funny with Dave. Dave and Leno, I've known for 20 years, and the nice thing about this book is I've been able to compile the arc of my relationship with them as well as their own relationship with each other in several pieces I've written for various publications. Culminating, I mean, basically after the heart thing where I did a full disclosure thing for Esquire, basically everything I knew to be true about Dave and Jay. I helped Jay write a book, too, by the way.
Yes.
Called Leading with My Chin.
Yeah. And I got to ask you about one of the stories in there.
Oh, good.
The Jeff Altman dinosaur story.
You're a smart man.
Thank you. Share that with my listeners and then tell me if it's true.
Well, there was a story. Well, this actually was sort of the last straw for me. The funniest thing, when I signed up to help Leno, I'd written a pretty rough piece about him. He had just started winning in the ratings, and I had just written a piece that basically was his first mea culpa about certain areas of skullduggery in terms of getting the job that Letterman probably earned, which would be the host of The Tonight Show. And it was a rough piece, and it ran in Esquire, but Leno kind of admired the piece. He thought, at least it's not another one of those nice guy pieces. Well, you know, the joke is everybody thinks he's the nice guy and Dave's the mean guy.
Yeah.
And in truth, it's kind of almost the opposite. Not that Leno's mean, but he's certainly a politicker, and he's cunning. And so I wrote a lot of, I basically told that story repeatedly. You really get to get a, I mean, I sort of been the Boswell to these two guys psychologically, I guess, for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in the course of doing the book, well, before I did the book, his producer, Debbie Vickers, came up to me. She said, does it matter if the stories are really true? Excuse me. And he wanted it to be a collection of stories that had happened on his way, his rise to the top. One story, a famous story, apparently, and I heard him once tell this story to Carson, by the way.
Yes,
and
I did too.
Carson was slayed by it.
Yep.
It was an appearance on the Dinah Shore Show, and for all comedians, they like to work out ahead of time with the band leader how they're going to be played off. In other words, the band will strike out after he tells his final joke. What will the final joke be? And then the band can just, you know, jump in and play him off, and either they go and sit at the couch. In this case, he was going to go sit at the couch with Dinah. So he had worked out ahead of time. This is how the story goes. He was going to say, thank you very much.
Because he didn't like giving away the punchline to his joke, even to the band leader, so he told the band leader, I'll just say, thank you very much, and then the band would come in and go, da 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 da, or whatever it is.
And then he'd go over and sit with Dinah.
Yeah.
So he came out, as the story goes, and Dinah introduces him, a very funny young comedian, Mr. Jay Leno. He was just on his way up at this point. And he comes out, and they play him on, and the band stops. He says, thank you very much. The band starts right up and plays him off, and he goes over to the panel, and Dinah, who'd barely been paying attention, said, that was the funniest material I've ever heard. And so goes the story. This never happened to Leno.
Yeah,
this happened to Jeff Altman. Leno gave Altman $1,000 so that he could own that story. I didn't know this till afterwards. Altman has always been in the Letterman camp, and I think the Letterman camp sort of leaked that story out to humiliate Leno once the book came out.
So the bottom line here is that the story did happen, but it didn't happen to Jay Leno. It happened to Jeff Altman.
Yeah, Jay plays fast and loose with the facts. You know, that tells you everything you need to know in a weird way about Jay Leno.
I can tell just by reading your pieces and also obviously talking to you here today that you've developed a contempt for this guy.
I'm disappointed in him because he was, if we can think back to the beginning of Late Night with David Letterman on NBC, once a month Leno would come out and he would be gangbusters. He'd be the greatest guest, but he was fearless. He did dangerous material. I mean, he's the one who called Mother Teresa, Mother Teresa, a conniving little bitch.
Right.
And I mean, try seeing that today. He's just watered himself down to almost nothing, and he's sort of the lowest common denominator, whereas Letterman always plays at the top of the room. Jay plays at the bottom of the room, and it's such a disappointment to me. And I really am sorry. But, I mean, he does it, and he wins. So what does that tell you about America?
What do these two guys think of each other today?
Well, I think Jay thinks Letterman's a genius, but also a tortured genius, which he is, by the way. And you know, Dave has little or no use for Jay. He's, you know, he knows Jay has basically, I mean, it was Letterman who begat Leno, you know, and suddenly Leno takes the, you know, the job that Letterman has earned, which is the job that Carson wanted him to have, which was to replace Carson. And I think, it just seems dishonorable. He politicked for it while Johnny was still in office, as we say, you know. And Dave would never have done that. He would have thought that he thought that to be disrespectful to Johnny, to make any kind of play for that job while Johnny was, you know, sitting up and taking solids, as he likes to say, you know.
Is it just that Letterman feels like Leno took his job, or does Letterman watch Leno's show and say this is just not good TV?
Yeah, well, Letterman has famously always said that he doesn't watch Leno at all. I don't entirely believe that. I think he's seen enough of it to know that it's silly. And plus, as I recount in the book, over the last couple years, especially after the Hart episode, Dave has been sort of merciless. He makes fun of Leno at any turn he can. And, of course, Leno will never acknowledge Dave on the air, but Dave just makes fun of. He does a great Leno impersonation, which we all do. If you spend time with Leno, you know, you always say, hey, Jamie, our relationship is over. I actually heard him say that after that last piece of the book came out.
And is your relationship with him over?
I guess it is for now. Who knows? I know too much about both of these boys, which I spill throughout the pages of this.
Yes, you do. And one of the things you also do in the book is tell stories about Helen Kushnick. And I'll make you a deal here. I'll tell my Helen Kushnick story if you'll tell one here on my show.
Sure.
Okay. Should I start?
You go.
I was working in Philadelphia in 1986. And Jay Leno had a holding deal with NBC because they wanted him and they were using him on The Tonight Show, but they weren't sure what they wanted to do with him, and they thought maybe they'd give him a variety show. And so they gave him a shot at producing a one-hour primetime variety show that would be him doing sketches and skits and interacting and doing filmed pieces, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was going to be produced in Philadelphia in a warehouse under the Ben Franklin Bridge.
It was about America, Jay Leno's America or something like that, wasn't it?
That's correct. And they were going to tape it over two nights, and the radio station I was working for got involved, and Jay came on my show, and we talked one morning of the week of pre-production, and we had a great time on the air, and he invited me to come down. Now, Friday night was going to be press night, but Thursday night was another night they were taping, and they were going to combine the best segments from both the two nights, and Jay invited me to come down on Thursday night. And so we got a whole bunch of tickets to give away to my listeners, and I went down there, and a bunch of my listeners were there, and my wife went with me, and we show up, and we watch it, and it's dreadful. As is the truth today, Jay can't do sketches.
Yeah.
And the people who write sketches for Jay must know that, and the sketches, well, whoever he had writing for him at the time are terrible. But, as my friend John Max, who writes for Jay now and works on this show every Friday, can tell you, Jay is a great joke teller, and when Jay would do that up on stage in front of this crowd there in Philadelphia, either in front of the camera or while they were setting up the next sketch, he would stand out there and work the crowd. He was terrific.
Yeah, nobody was better. He was the Bruce Springsteen of stand-up.
That's right. So the next morning, Friday morning, I go on my radio show, and I talk about how Jay was great with these elements, and he was horrible with these elements. And if they're smart, they'll make a special about Jay Leno doing stand-up and working with the audience and leave out all these crappy sketches. Okay, and I say, but I'm going to go tonight again and see how it is, and I'll report back to you on Monday morning. So again, Friday night, my wife and I get in the car, we drive down to this warehouse under the Ben Franklin Bridge, we get out, we walk in, now we're going to have seats in the VIP area because it's press night, and we're going to be in that section. We walk in, we sit down at the table that they've got set up for us and a bunch of other press people, and within 5 seconds, Helen Kushnick, who is Jay Leno's horrendous manager, I mean horrendous as a person, not as a manager.
Yeah, well, she got her job done.
Well, yeah, she turned out to be that later. But anyway, at the time, she was doing a fairly good job for him, but she was in charge of this TV show. She storms up to me at this table and says, "Get out!"
Really?
I mean, yells in my face, like a micron away from my nose. She's face-to-face with me. "Get out!" And I say, "What's wrong, Helen?" You almost ruined this show. Brandon Tartikoff heard your radio show this morning and almost canceled this whole project. We're almost not here tonight because of you. Now get out.
Okay.
And I said, Helen, everything I said was true. I was just being completely honest in my opinion, and I'll leave if you want me to, but that's not going to change the fact that Jay is doing the wrong kind of show for Jay Leno. Get out! Get out! I mean, she was horrendously PO'd at me.
Oh, well, she was a very, very violent woman. I mean, Kathy Bates played her in the HBO movie The Late Shift.
And it was very, very lifelike. I mean, I still have flashbacks from that, as you can tell. I think if I had stayed another half a second, she would have hauled off and hit me. And, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. But my wife and I got the heck out of there.
Yeah, you did the right thing.
And I heard from other people that Friday night was worse than Thursday night was, and so of course, I reported that on my Monday morning show.
Yeah.
So that's my Helen Kushnick story.
By the way, that show was actually a terrible special. You'll notice it'll never see the light of day again.
Well, you know what? It aired once. 6 months later, they were going to put it on during sweeps because Jay was such an up-and-coming star at the network. It did not air in February like it was supposed to air. It aired in the middle of the summer, like in August, in Saturday Night Live slot on a weekend when SNL was, you know,
dark
not even
summer,
was
yeah.
going to be dark for the summer, right? They didn't promote it. They didn't do anything. I happened to see it, and the broadcast version played up all the sketches and played down Jay's brilliant monologue and joke stuff, and that's why it never went anywhere. It was absolutely the reverse of what Jay Leno is good at, and Helen Kushnick was responsible for that.
Yeah, no, just what a horrible episode in his life. She you know, she's dead now, but, you know, a lot of people thought she was too mean to continue to live. She had a lot of problems. I mean, she'd given birth to a kid who was given an HIV, injection, not injection, but a transfusion early on, and lost the kid, and she had breast cancer. But all these things you would think would make her more a benevolent person. And in fact, she was just ragingly angry about everything.
And you know, I love that claim, by the way, that the president of NBC was going to cancel a project with one of their up-and-coming stars because a radio guy in Philadelphia didn't like it.
You're the hottest, buddy.
Oh, yeah. Now, all right. I got a break. We'll come back and talk some more about Johnny Carson. And Bill Zemme may be the person who made Barry Manilow hip, if such a thing is possible, and lots of other people he's interviewed. They're all collected in what is the book of the week on my website, harrisonline.com. It's called Intimate Strangers, Comic Profiles and Indiscretions of the Very Famous Bill Zemme, here on the Paul Harris Show. I want to go back to the very first question I was trying to ask you before we get off on Regis and Letterman and Leno and all the other stuff we talked about, which is, Bill, what makes you want to interview somebody?
Well, there's so few of these people who are of any interest to me anymore. I after I pulled Johnny Carson out of retirement last year, marking the 10 years of his absence from The Tonight Show, people have been saying to me, who's left? And I am at a loss. I mean, I feel like I have to be a grave robber now to go find people I'm interested in.
Hmm. Is that the thing? It has to be somebody that you like and that you're interested in?
Generally, the book is full of, it's about half and half. It's about those they sent me after and those that I worked hard to go find and track down and spend time with, a la Barry Manilow, for instance, who I thought, what would it be like to be a living joke? You know, when your name is a punchline, you live in hell is the first line of the sentence. And
yeah.
How does one get through life being that kind of pop mock icon, you know? By and large, I mean, I'm interested in their humanity. I mean, I make a big point of saying in the introduction that I sort of seek to de-celebrify them and find their, you know, their human traits and their flaws and their quirks, and also try and, you know, celebrity journalism, I maintain, is the lowest form of journalism. It's just, it's disgusting. I mean, and certainly now more than ever, when infotainment is a word that Webster's defines, you know, it's a frightening world in which we live. You've got all these, you know, extras and Access Hollywood and E.T., and it's the cheapest time alive to be famous. It doesn't take too much. And therefore, these people are not all that interesting, and the flavors of the month have never been all that intriguing to me. But I've always liked people with a body of work, a career, you know. And for the most part, I've been able to chase down those kind of folks. You know, everyone from Sinatra, which was basically his last interview on the planet. I went to him. I sought him out as an oracle for men. I thought men had lost their way and didn't know how to behave, comport themselves with any kind of self-confidence any longer. We second-guessed ourselves left and right. And here was a man who never wavered. He had a very firm policy of style in every matter and area of life. And so I asked him questions that could help a guy, you know, like, what do you do when a woman cries, or how do you get over a broken heart? And so basically, it was the last thing he did before he passed away. He was just ending his career, basically, and then he didn't last more than a couple years in retirement. He had to be Frank Sinatra every day, and there's no way to be Frank Sinatra in pajamas at home. He's withered there.
And when you do these profiles, and by the way, I that's why I say you're a profiler, not in the FBI sense, but in the way that it's the opposite of suck-up journalism like E.T. and Access Hollywood and the others you mentioned. That's what I call those. I don't know if journalism can fit in there, but it certainly, if so, should be preceded by the word suck-up.
Yeah, it's just an embarrassment. In order for me to live with myself writing, because people seem to want me to write about these people, and by and large, when I'm done with them, they're pretty pleased that I brought out the humanity, and I tease them. I tease them mercilessly, but at the same time, I don't think it's ever mean-spirited.
How do you convince Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone, one of the, at the time, still hippest magazines in America? You wrote the piece in 1990. How do you convince them we should do a piece on Barry Manilow?
Well, I just thought the facts spoke for themselves. This guy was not going to go away, and he hasn't. And I think I did. I mean, it turns out he has a great sense of humor about being the mocked icon that he is. And at the same time, he's resilient and a well-therapized guy. I mean, he certainly needed it in order to survive all the, you know. I mean, he was sort of the secret shame. We all sort of secretly like at least one Barry Manilow song, but we would not admit it to our friends. So I thought, what is that like to be him? And but look at, I mean, he had just an amazing string of gold records, and it was just time for Rolling Stone to pay attention to the guy.
And how hard was it to sell that to them?
Well, I think that it took a while. It took a few months, but I said, no, we got to do this. And eventually, Wenner loved that piece. Jan Wenner thought that way. But I will tell you, after I wrote the piece, it sat there. They were afraid to publish it for about 11 months. It sat there for about 11 months. I had to go back and freshen it up.
I'm sure they had to make space for yet another piece on The Clash.
That was exactly right. Right about that time. Yes, sir.
Yeah. When Bill does profiles of these various celebrities, he doesn't just spend an hour with them, as I'm doing here with him today. He actually spends hours, plural, in fact, days, and sometimes much more, and sometimes gets much more intimately involved in the profiles. For instance, he got naked with Sharon Stone.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here was the deal. I had written about her for Rolling Stone when Basic Instinct came out, and we struck up a nice rapport. I wrote a piece about her. In Rolling Stone, I basically portrayed her as the devil because she just lived to torment men. And she tormented me in various ways during the reporting of that piece, which I didn't reveal until I came back into her life. And we'd stayed in contact to some degree, but she was out making Casino in Las Vegas, and Esquire dispatched me to go catch up with Sharon again, and I to promote a movie I think called The Quick and the Dead. And so I met with her at a coffee shop. We had lunch, and then she said, "You're going to come back to my house after lunch. I have a surprise for you." And right there, you're thinking, well, Sharon Stone, okay.
There we go.
There we go, buddy.
Yeah.
No, already I was filled with fear because I knew she would do something to humiliate me. So we walk into her. She had rented a house on a golf course in Las Vegas. Walk into the door, and she says, "All right, take off your clothes." And then I look
here
in the living
go.
Room. And
here we go. Here we go.
And until I look in the living room, there stood two husky Norwegian-looking women standing next to massage tables. And her dream was that she and I would be massaged together, like we were members of the Friars Club or something, in her living room while the tape ran and we talked more about life.
Uh-huh.
Try carrying out a conversation when you're naked next to Sharon Stone.
I don't think I could.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. But, I mean, the minute, so she and the ladies left the room, and I walk into the, I take off my clothes as she ordered me to do, because what are you going to do when she orders you?
Completely naked, Bill?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. And then you get under the, I get on the table under the thing, under the sheet, and the table collapses.
Oh!
It's like I almost killed her cat. Her cat was there. I was like, and I swear she did that on purpose. Big crash, and then they come running out. I said, no, I'll be fine. Don't worry. And then she eventually emerges in her little robe and slips under her thing. And yeah, it was okay.
Was there any shared nudity?
Well, no, we didn't cuddle. But we were on separate tables, and it's a piece that people will never let me forget.
Yeah.
I mean, afterwards we put on robes and baked cookies together. It's an unusual piece, I got to tell you.
Yeah, I got to tell you, there are two things you say in the piece, which you just illustrated the first, which is men fear her, and the second one. Let me read this directly from the book. Sharon Stone is the only female movie star left who knows how to be a movie star. Now, what does that mean?
She always looks good. She knew how to really, she sort of faded a little bit. I predict a comeback for her. I think she had a little brain aneurysm scare here in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But she just, she always seemed to be glamorous in a, and also playful and, kind of a, she's actually the last great broad, which, and I say that in Sinatra-esque terms, which means nothing but the highest compliment. She knows how to throw it around. She can go head-to-head and toe-to-toe with any guy, and she's funny. She's actually she's very funny. It's too bad that she made this comedy with Albert Brooks, my hero, who I write about called The Muse, and it was a terrible movie. But I'd long been campaigning for her to do romantic comedy or something.
You and I may be the only two people in show business. Grant that I'm at the lowest possible level of it in radio. It's me and Carney's at this point, I'll grant you. But
cut it out.
But you and I may be the only people who have publicly professed their love for an Albert Brooks movie called Modern Romance.
Oh, it's the greatest movie ever.
It is the greatest movie about the desperation of men in love.
Men in love.
And you got to spend time with Albert, something I've never had the honor of doing. Tell me about him.
He's a remarkable guy. I went back, the piece that appears in the book, it's called Albert Brooks is the Howard Hughes of comedy, and if there are listeners who may not be familiar with Albert, I mean, he's best known probably for his role in Broadcast News, where he played, with Holly Hunter and William Hurt.
Right.
This sort of the desperate news anchor reporter who sweated prodigiously on camera.
Yep.
But he's an oracle. This guy is just considered in comedy to be the funniest human being alive. There was a time where he would, this is all born of insecurity, of course, as so much of comedy is, but he was always funny. I mean, if he was going to be with a human being, he would be hilarious, or else he'd have to go be by himself and lock himself up in his house. And thus he became the recluse, Albert Brooks, who would, make a movie every 4 years and then disappear again. But I spent time with him, and he was always just, he had just made the movie Defending Your Life, which is a beautiful fable of a movie. Again, a little milder than the acidic tones of Lost in America, which is a great movie, and Modern Romance, which is the greatest movie about breaking up in history.
Right.
In fact, Stanley Kubrick so admired that movie that it inspired him to make Eyes Wide Shut. And then, of course, that turned out to be a lousy movie.
Wow, I'm sure Albert wasn't happy to hear that.
Yeah. Well, he was flattered till he saw the movie.
Now, you mentioned The Muse, the movie that Brooks made with Sharon Stone, and he's also made that movie Mother with Debbie Reynolds. These have all come since marriage and fatherhood have entered his life, which I think have affected him negatively. What do you
think? Absolutely. You're an astute observer of Albert Brooks. I'll tell you, I did a Playboy interview with Albert a few years ago, just before The Muse came out. And at this point, he was married and had a kid, and there was another one on the way. And he had certainly lost that drive to be constantly funny. He grounded himself in a family, and God bless him. He's probably a saner man for it. But it was sort of alarming to be with Albert Brooks and him not actually making you want to, spit up milk through your nostrils when you're with him,
Who have you interviewed who has disappointed you the most, Bill?
I mean, there's a classic interview, they call it the impossible interview, the Warren Beatty piece. But I love that guy. He's a brilliant, brilliant conversationalist, unless you turn on a tape recorder and try to get him to say something on the record. And the piece is sort of, it was the first piece he had done in about 13 years, any kind of interview. he was finishing up Dick Tracy, and he was trying to appeal to a new generation. So Rolling Stone was chosen as his vehicle, and he would be on the cover, and I was chosen as his inquisitor. And he's so astute, but he thought too much about what he was going to say, and he would stop mid-sentence and pause and edit his sentences as he was speaking them, and it became comical. I'd never seen anything like it, and the pauses were elephantine. They were enormous, and we came up with a device where I thought it would be funny if we timed his pauses in the transcribing of the tapes and then shared with you, the home reader, just what I was going through if you consulted the second hand of your timepiece and played along. I mean, you have no idea what... Now, 11-second pause on radio would be dead, right?
Yes, it would.
Think about 57 seconds and on and on. And you're just staring at him, and he's staring at you, and he's not finishing his sentences. So I interrupt the piece throughout and describe all my homicidal impulses about how I want to kill him. And it seems to be a piece people kind of remember. But I will tell you, off the record, he was fantastic. But on the record, he was awful.
All right, so he was a kind of a disappointment in that way, but it turned into a classic piece. Who surprised you the most? Who did you go into thinking, I don't want to do this, this is not going to be good, and yet it turned out to be wonderful?
Well, I usually could call it. Regis was great. I wasn't entirely sure that was going to work out. Regis was fantastic. Generally, ingenues worry me. I don't think these young women have much to say because they haven't lived enough life yet. I had a very good time with Cameron Diaz, even though she was another reticent one. It's an interesting thing about a piece. It actually ran last year in Esquire, but it is in the book. I had written it just before the world blew up, the year before, and it was about to go to press on the morning of September 11th to be the November cover of Esquire of 2001. Of course, that happened, and we all decided, well, we can't do this because it's kind of a silly piece. She's a very game girl, and it turned into a very funny, kind of dizzy comic tone to the piece. I thought, well, I'm going to have to rewrite this from top to bottom because this is a whole new world we're living in. We waited until her last film, I think The Sweetest Thing, which was a bomb, came out earlier in the spring, and I found that I didn't have to rewrite it that much. I thought, well, you know what, maybe we can still make fun of our icons, in a teasing way, and she was a pretty game customer.
Bill, you've interviewed so many people, and you stay in touch with them for years and years. Letterman and Leno for 20 years, and some of these other people you've known and gone back and re-interviewed them, and you insert yourself into the profiles. You're very much Bill Zemi is very much a character in any profile of anybody else. Do you ever run the risk of becoming a little bit too famous to be an interviewer?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I've been doing this show on the Bravo Network, and it just ended its first run. It's called Second City Presents,
right.
It's basically the a comedian's version of the Actor's Studio show that James Lipton hosts.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to, I don't know. It was odd for me to step into the television limelight and be an on-camera interviewer. I mean, I've certainly been on TV talking about other people, usually on these biography shows, I'll pop up now and again. But to be running a show was a peculiar thing. I don't know if I mean, I try to insert myself as a comic foil in the pieces. If it makes sense for me to be having a harrowing time with one of these people, then it's worth me putting in. I just feel like you're lying if you don't say. Yeah, there's so many writers who say, a reporter sat with Sharon Stone. Well, it's like, no, it's you.
Right.
And I just think there's something dishonest about that. But I want to make it feel human, so I guess that's what I do.
Final thing we've got to talk about here, and I've only got a couple minutes left. When I asked you who was a disappointment, I thought maybe you'd mention Arnold Schwarzenegger. I know you include your piece with him in there, but I can tell you from my own experience interviewing Arnold, I guess about 10 years ago when he made the movie Junior, it wasn't until about 3 or 4 minutes into the interview that I realized this guy's one of the worst interview subjects ever.
Ever.
And it's mostly because he has no sense of humor.
It's amazing. I offended him by asking him funny questions.
Yeah, so did I.
I asked him, I said, do you think you could bench press Sylvester Stallone? Why should I want to? What do you shame your magazine with these questions?
I asked him when the movie Junior was about Arnold's character becoming pregnant, and I asked him, now, Arnold, if a woman could make you pregnant, which woman would you like to have do that? And you could almost hear the steam coming out of his ears over the phone lines as I talked to him, and he, that's not what the movie is about.
It's amazing. Now, the funniest thing about Arnold, if you see him, he's really good when he goes on, he's pretty good with Leno. I don't think Letterman is too interested in having him on the show.
I don't think so, because I think he only gives rehearsed answers.
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. He knows what his material is going to be. So if you try, you can't stump Arnold. He's just, the piece was, I call it The Importance of Being Arnold. And again, it's sort of a mock, whereas Sinatra, I meant it completely, that men had lost their way and we needed a role model, and he was a guy who could do it, and also at the end of an era, too. But with Arnold, I did sort of a mock version of, this was a time when men were going out in the woods and, beating on logs and howling and wearing loincloths, and I thought, boy, this is pretty pathetic. I guess they just want to be Arnold. So I tried to make Arnold sort of the sensitivity training instructor in terms of men getting tough again.
He won't play along and doesn't understand the hypothetical.
Yeah, so I just teased the hell out of him, frankly, in this piece, and he has no use for me at all whatsoever, but it's good as one of the funnier pieces, I think.
It's a terrific collection of pieces like that and many others with much more cooperative subjects. It's called Intimate Strangers, Comic Profiles and Indiscretions of the Very Famous. And, Bill, I always enjoy talking to you.
It's always a delight, Paul.
Thank you very much. Bill Zemme here on The Paul Harris Show.